This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, and welcome to The Joy of Text, a podcast about Judaism and sexuality. We'll start out this episode with a question from one of our listeners. Then we will be joined by Ora Weinbach, who is a sexuality education teacher at the Heschel School in New York. And we'll conclude the episode with a final word. With me to discuss this are Rabbi Dov Linzer, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, president of JOFA and the clinical director of Maze Women's Health. My name is Rabbi Remy Smith, and I'm the moderator of The Joy of Text. Today's question is, do we really have to separate after sex on our wedding night? I'm nervous enough as it is, and knowing that we will separate after being intimate in a new way is adding to my anxiety. Can't we cuddle afterward so I will feel held and supported?
Before you say anything, I just need to say this listener has clearly not been listening to many podcasts because she would say we're having intercourse on our wedding night.
Yeah.
Okay. So
true.
Because there are many ways to have sex and that's not all intercourse. Okay, Dov.
Thank you.
Conversation can be intimate.
So let me give a little context. Do they have to have sex on the wedding night? That is a misconception. It's a myth. And we really need to dispel that because a lot of women feel that they're not ready, overly rushed, especially if the couple has been really good about following halacha, then they have not been physically intimate. And all of a sudden on the wedding night, they're supposed to go from 0 to 60 and then back to 0 all in one night. So the idea that they must have sex on the wedding night has been very harmful. If they didn't feel they have to have sex on the wedding night and they don't, then that would give them more time to be physically intimate and to have sex in other ways and to be sexual in other ways before they actually had vaginal intercourse, which then would require them to separate. So where did this idea come from that they have to have sex on the wedding night? Well, the Gemara describes the first act of sex between husband and wife as biat mitzvah, mitzvah sex. And the perception became that that meant that it had to be that first night. But actually, the reason that this is considered to be a special mitzvah more than in general marital intercourse is because there's a presumption that the woman is very desirous to have sex that night. And the husband's obligation to have sex with his wife, the mitzvah of onan, which we've discussed before, is particularly in the cases where his wife is interested and desirous of having sex. And actually, if the woman specifically does not want to, then they should not be having sex. So there really is no mitzvah to have sex on the wedding night.
I think that's great. I think it's a really important point to make because, you know, we were talking a little bit before we were recording and I was saying how almost every woman I know before she has vaginal intercourse for the first time is petrified. I mean, she's scared. It's scared because you hear horror stories, but honestly, it shouldn't be painful. It doesn't have to be painful. And knowing that you can kind of work up to that until it's something you want to do and feels more natural is really, it's like a bracha that you can do it that way.
So the reason that halacha says that a couple separates on their wedding night is an idea called dam betulim, which is hymenal bleeding. And it's actually ironic because in the Mishnah, in the early stage, the hymenal bleeding was a reason that a woman did not have to be concerned that blood she was seeing was her period, and she did not have to be concerned that she was anita because it was hymenal bleeding and therefore not a problem. But already in the Gemara that began to develop, and then it continued afterwards in the Gaonic period, where it finally came to a stage where A, hymenal bleeding was treated as if it was a woman's menstrual bleeding, and B, even when there was no blood seen, there was a presumption that if the woman was a virgin, there was hymenal bleeding, and therefore she had to treat herself as anita. So that's what it's rooted in. So the first thing to know is that it only applies to a woman who is a virgin. If a woman has had sex before the wedding night, and by which I mean intercourse, vaginal intercourse before the wedding night, then although Allah does not approve of that, but nevertheless, this law would not apply. That's number one. Number two, there are tshuvot, responsa by Rav Moshe Feinstein, that if the hymen was surgically removed for whatever reason, this law would not apply. Then the next level of question becomes, let's say it was not surgically removed, but it was punctured due to some accident or due to a woman who is very active, and that led to a tearing of the hymen. And there, too, there are some opinions that that does not apply. And there actually are, my understanding is, a growing number of rabbanim that are telling women to go to a gynecologist before their wedding night. And if the gynecologist says that there is no hymen or that the hymen is ruptured enough that it basically would look as it would look after intercourse, that she does not have to be concerned about the issue of dam betulim, of hymenal vaginal bleeding. I do want to qualify that, though, and say that that assumes that there is no blood. If after they have intercourse, she does see blood, then these laws would apply. They would have to separate, but there's no need to go looking for it. But the general automatic rule that they have to separate wouldn't apply if a woman's had intercourse or for other reasons the hymen is no longer present or is in a state that it would be after intercourse.
Can I just clarify a little bit about hymens? Because please. I feel like people have so many misconceptions. People think of hymens as a covering on the vaginal canal. Obviously, it's not that, because if it was that, then your menstrual blood couldn't get through. Think of the hymen as kind of a ring around the vagina, and any kind of activity wears and tears it away. So it starts to get frayed or ripped or bent, or it's got a couple tears in it. It's stretched a little bit. So practitioners can't say to you, oh, this is an intact hymen or not. Basically, if a hymen is maneuvered in such a way at this point that a penis can get in and out without any more ripping, then you don't have a hymen anymore.
Right. So that's why I didn't frame it as the gynecologist should say the hymen is not there, but that
intact.
It looks like it's in a similar state as after she's had sex. Or
correct.
Another way to ask the question is, do you think that I will bleed after intercourse? And if the answer to that is no, or the answer to the first question is yes, it looks like it would look like after sex, then this law would not automatically apply. But again, I do want to reiterate that if a woman does see blood, then she does have to treat herself as needed, but she doesn't have to go looking for it. And more I'm hearing that Rabbanim are telling women to go to a gynecologist and check that out.
And I'll just throw something in there. For those women who may be listening or have friends who are getting married who are really nervous about intercourse for the first time, I'm a very big fan of dilators. I don't know how people are going to respond to this from a halachic perspective, but they make these vaginal dilators. And knowing that you can insert a dilator into yourself and it doesn't hurt is very empowering and makes women often feel very much like, okay, I know this is not going to hurt me. Not to mention the fact that if you put a dilator in that's the size of the penis and you pull it out and you put it in and you pull it out and there's no blood, you'd be pretty sure at that point that your hymen
solves that other
enough.
Problem as well.
Solves the other problem as well.
Right.
So I guess I just have one last question for you, which is that, is there anybody out there who says that if you do have intercourse and there is blood, or you haven't found out that your hymen is ripped, that you can spend some time together afterwards before separating? Or does everybody pretty much across the board say that's not okay?
Right, which actually was part of the initial question. So the phrase in the Gemara is they have that first act of sex, bilat mitzvah, that's that word, the sex of the mitzvah, because it's that first act of sex between husband and wife, and then they separate. So overwhelmingly, the Rishonim and the Poskim, the medieval commentators and the halachic authorities rule that separate means fully separate. She's treated as a nida, and that means sleeping in separate beds and so on. And that's certainly how Shulchan Aruch rules and how all of the Poskim rule. It is, though, interesting to note that a number of the students of Rashi in their various works actually said that the couple is allowed to still cuddle and be in the bed together as long as they're not naked, as long as they're wearing pajamas. And actually the phrase that's used by them is because of kavod chatanim, honor of the wedding, and essentially recognizing that in order to allow this couple to have this intimacy and not to be so challenging to have to fully separate, that given that it's really hymenal bleeding and not menstrual bleeding, they understood that the halacha did not go all the way here and require full separation. So they don't spell out all the implications. I think it's clear they're not talking about sexual contact, but they are talking about intimacy and being held and so on. But again, this is a very minority opinion, and certainly all the poskim have ruled that they do have to fully separate.
Nice to know there was some sensitivity to
yes,
it, though.
Yes, absolutely.
I love the word kavod that they're giving.
There's
I
your
love
dignity.
The word kavod, and I think it gives a lot of respect to the aftermath of intercourse and how there's an emotional piece there, that it's not just about the act, that there are people behind the act of sex, and these are emotional people on their wedding night, and it's not just two people doing an act and then it's over.
They're
going
yeah, sloppy.
If we're assuming
right.
that people are leading halachic lives, to experience a level of vulnerability and then have to separate so quickly and harshly, I think that sounds like it could be really traumatic. And to say the word kavod and give respect to what the experience is, and especially the people behind the experience, I actually think that's a really lovely word.
Great. So.
And now, a brief word from our sponsor.
Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is proud of its new class of 12 rabbis, which brings our total to 120 rabbis now serving Jewish communities. These modern Orthodox rabbis are making a difference in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovevei Torah rabbi, come visit us and see what we're all about. For source sheets to accompany the Joy of Text episodes and for other great Torah, visit our Torah library at www.yctorah.org.
Our guest today is Ora Weinbach. Orah teaches Limudei Kodesh and sexuality education at the Abraham Joshua Heschel High School and is the community scholar at the Young Israel of Scarsdale. She earned her degree in Jewish education from Yeshiva University. Since completing a certificate program in sexuality education from Planned Parenthood, Orah has been developing educational initiatives to improve sexuality education in the Orthodox community. Welcome to the show, Orah.
I'm so excited to be here. I've been a fan for a really long time.
We're glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit how you came to be involved in teaching sex ed.
So it actually happened by accident a little bit. I was not intending to teach high school sexuality education. I wanted to get a certification in sexuality education to do sexuality education in the Orthodox community, particularly for young women in preparation for getting married. I felt like that was a huge void in my own life and among the life of my friends. And I decided to pursue the certification in order to do more adult education. I happened to be teaching Limudei Kodesh at the Heschel School at the time and knew that they covered generously part of any continuing education program that you were doing. So in an effort to kind of have a financial assistance in pursuing this, I approached the head of the school to ask if this is something that the school would consider covering. And they so generously agreed. And once I started working on the certification, I started to notice places in the school that really the kids needed a little bit more formal and comprehensive sexuality education. And so there was a health class in existence at the time already for ninth graders. It was once a week for half a semester. It covered a whole wide range of things, anywhere from stress, sleep, healthy eating, drugs and alcohol, and sex. And everyone knew it was an important class to have. It was a super big priority for the school, but nobody actually wanted to teach it. So in finding out that this class existed and I was getting the certification and the school was generously assisting me in doing so, I offered to take on teaching this class. And I developed a curriculum from scratch based on what I perceived to be the needs of the students and in conversations with our amazing school psychologist. And I developed the curriculum, and that's how I began teaching.
Wow.
What do you think the biggest challenge facing high school students with regard to sex education is? What's missing? Like, if you had to say what sex education the kids need to get that they're not getting, what would be the biggest topic or two?
I think the biggest challenge, at least in the population that I'm teaching, is a lot of them think that they know a lot about sex because they've seen porn, obviously, and like that's what sex is. None of them would say that in a classroom setting, but there's a lot of posturing about making it look like you know so much about sex, maybe even look like you're sexually active, when really nobody's really sure exactly how true that is. And really most of the information that they're getting is either from watching porn themselves, from watching movies, from music that they listen to, basically different places within the media, or hearing their friends talk about it who are equally ill-informed. Really where the biggest gaps are is kind of the real stuff, the things that you wouldn't necessarily get from porn. So hygiene is huge. Actually understanding body parts and knowing what they're called and what they are, because they know all the words. They've even seen it, but they're not exactly sure how to match up word to body part, how things work. And also, it just comes to mind every time I think about this. When I teach anatomy, I put a picture of a vulva on the board, and I intentionally choose one that has pubic hair on it. And the kids are horrified. Horrified. They're like, what? Why are there pubes on that picture? And because they think they know what sex is like, but pubic hair is so absent for them. Girls who have pubic hair and know that it's there feel a certain amount of shame and discomfort about it. And really, some boys literally don't know that it exists. Mm-hmm. Also, a huge component is conversation and communication. One of the things was really important to me in teaching the course was that it's co-ed. And one of the reasons why that's so important to me is really one of the goals of the course is encouraging kids to feel comfortable talking about sex with each other, particularly with their partners. And that starts in the classroom, encouraging kids to be able to ask questions, make comments, answer questions in front of each other. Creates the opportunity for conversation. And when we talk about the idea that you really should be talking about sexual interactions before, during, and after, they kind of get the before. they're really weirded out about the during, and I try to explain to them there's other ways to communicate other than asking specific, fully articulated questions, but that communication, the idea that you talk to somebody about a sexual interaction after the fact mm-hmm. is so foreign to them. So it's those kinds of things, those real life parts of sexuality that really don't get covered in the media, that really is a big gap, I find.
So I think it's really important to point out here. I think some people might hear this and get a little weirded out, like, oh my God, you're talking about all that stuff. You're just going to be encouraging them to have sex. And I know we've mentioned this before, but I think all the studies show that the more this is talked about, the more responsible people are about sex, and actually lowers the frequency of sex. So could you share some of your experience around those issues?
Sure. So I'm sure this has been said a million times. It's super hard to get actual data about that. And I don't know how sexually active exactly what my students are doing, although sometimes I get too much of a picture that I don't really want. Whenever anybody asks a question about a cousin or my friend or like, what if someone, like, you know that really they're talking about themselves. So I can't give you numbers or concrete details, but that fear that I've heard about a lot kind of is lingering there, although I haven't encountered it. I think that usually the voice of that would be the parent body saying, we're so concerned that you're exposing our kids to this. I have not once in the 2 full years that I've been in this role in the school encountered a parent who has been upset by anything I've taught. I mean, maybe their kids aren't telling them, which is also a possibility. Although we do a component. Starting last year, we did a component of parent education, which I can talk about more.
It is also that Heschel is not an Orthodox school.
Right. So that's obviously a huge component of it. Heschel is a pluralistic school, which gives me a tremendous amount of freedom in terms of what I can and can't teach, which I don't think that I would necessarily have if I was doing sexuality education at an Orthodox school. So I think that the expectations and those pressures that are coming from more of an Orthodox perspective, I don't really encounter that as much.
But, so I'm just going to reiterate that point. Every piece of data suggests that the more you educate children, the more you talk to them, the later they act and the more responsibly they behave.
Just to build off of that for 1 second. So sometimes the kids, particularly the ones who are a little bit more uncomfortable, are like, well, why do we have this? The other half of the room is like, of course we need to have this, but they can't even themselves articulate why. So part of what I talk with the kids about is when you pre-think your decision, you're going to make a better decision than if you don't think about it at all. And this is something that high school kids don't really feel fully. I think that the impulsiveness of their prefrontal cortex not being fully developed yet. But when you find yourself in a situation and you have to make a snap decision, the factors that are going to be playing into your decision are peer pressure, disappointing the other person, what you're going to look like, all those things that kids, hormones, how could I overlook hormones? All those things that when kids are sitting in a classroom, they can say and acknowledge and really understand that those are not the things that should be motivating their decision. At the same time, they can then understand that in the moment, those are the things that will make their decision. Mm-hmm. And we talk about how if you practice saying what you would want to do in a certain situation, that actually empowers you to make that decision in the moment in a way that you really just would not be capable of doing otherwise, which is something that really speaks to them, both in terms of decisions about how they want conversations to go about sex. But I know also when I'm speaking particularly my high school girls as they get older and really 11th grade and really in 12th grade as they're preparing to go off to college are incredibly scared about rape and sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And we talk about how I sit with them and I just say, like, say no to me. Just say, like, in your head, just say no. And some of them really can't. They're actually uncomfortable with me. It's just girls. We're just, I'm not even asking them to do anything. They're just, I'm having them practice say the word no. And it's a hard word for them to say. Having kids practice verbalizing, pre-thinking the interactions that they're going to have really enables them and empowers them to make better decisions in the moment.
Right.
That's amazing. I noticed that you keep saying sexuality education and not sex education. So can you talk a little bit about the difference between sex education and sexuality education, if there's a difference at all?
Sure. So thank you for noticing. I'm actually really intentional in calling it sexuality education. It's a little bit of a mouthful. So sometimes I do abbreviate it and call it sex ed. But sexuality education is different because it acknowledges that what we're trying to teach and learn is about much more than sex. When you say sex, people think either super narrowly of vaginal intercourse, or even if they're being super expansive, they think about any sort of intimate or romantic or sexual behaviors that take place between one or two or more, whatever people. That's what they think when they think about sex. Sexuality education hopefully is a lot more than that. We're talking about anatomy, which is part of sex, but also super separate. You could have a relationship to your body and to parts of your body that are normally associated with sex that are super separate from anything inherently sexual. We talk about gender and sexuality. We have a lesson about LGBTQ issues, which also is not strictly related to sex. And we talk about consent, which also, again, is not strictly related to having sex or not having sex. There's consent, and the idea of having a consensual relationship with somebody is so much bigger than that. The term sexuality education is much broader and really creates the opportunity to see sex as part of a broader part of one's sexual self, which is something that I hope to make kids a little bit more comfortable with.
Terrific. So I want to say it's just so refreshing and exciting to hear what you're teaching and that you have the opportunity to do so, and particularly in a Jewish school, because it's certainly my impression that sex education probably could be better all around, but probably is not great in the Jewish schools. And I wanted to actually just share a brief story. My son, he's in a special ed school, so it's not a Jewish school. And in his health class, they basically completely avoid talking about sex. And I couldn't believe it. I said, this isn't a Jewish school. I don't understand. He was up in arms because he said, we are an at-risk population. How could they not be teaching us about sex? He says, for about 5 minutes in 4 years, they mention STDs, and that's about it. So he says to me, I bet at least in Orthodox schools, they teach about abstinence. I said, no, they pretty much pretend it doesn't exist, which is exactly the message he was getting.
It's so interesting that you say that, though. I think we do as a Jewish community and then also as an Orthodox community have our own particular challenges with sexuality education, but it's not something that just we as a Jewish community are struggling. The entire world, but for sure the United States of America is struggling with this as a nation in terms of there's such a wide range and differences in terms of laws. It's totally state dependent, and there's a huge range of differences. You read the laws and you read the curriculums that are in place in some of these public schools. It's horrific. Mm-hmm. It's not just
a Jewish problem.
It's not just a Jewish problem. It's really a national problem. It's a human problem, because sexuality is so part of being human that the way we treat it is going to just be present, going to be an issue or a topic of conversation no matter where you are, from developing countries to America to the Orthodox community to whoever.
Can you tell us an example or give us a case where you felt like something happened in school, a conversation or a class, which really made a difference in somebody's life? Not to put you on the spot.
Okay. So I was teaching about the external female anatomy, so the vulva. And in general, that's a really big shocker class for the kids. But obviously, the two things are so intertwined that I can't teach about anatomy without talking about pleasure. So inherent in the conversation about both male and female sexual organs is talking about them in the way that they pertain to pleasure. So I was teaching about the clitoris, and orgasm came up, obviously, because how do you talk about the clitoris without talking about orgasm? And one kid raises their hand, and they say,
it's a boy or girl?
It's a girl.
Okay.
Isn't it true that you can fake an orgasm? I saw it on Friends. So I said, I mean, it depends on how good of an actress you are, but the question is really, why would you want to fake an orgasm? And then there was silence in the room. And I said, no, really, why would somebody want to fake having an orgasm? Silence. And I said, okay, let's talk about cookies instead. Somebody bakes you a horrendous batch of cookies, and you eat them, and you lie to them, and you say that they're such good cookies. Why would you do that? And then once we're talking about cookies, we're not talking about vulvas anymore. Everyone all of a sudden feels comfortable saying why they would lie to somebody. You don't want to hurt their feelings. They work so hard to make the cookies for you. All those reasons. And then I said, guys, what happens if you lie about somebody making bad cookies? They make you more bad cookies. And then we talked about how every time you're going to have to eat bad cookies. And it was just a hysterical moment. The kids were laughing because it was obviously this hysterical double entendre, but it enabled them to talk about the experience of orgasm and communication within a relationship in a way that was totally relatable.
Why do you think there was that silence when you first said, why would somebody fake an orgasm? Do you think that they couldn't figure it out, or they were embarrassed to talk about it?
I think it's probably some combination of the two, but I think that they're inherently connected. Part of teaching is creating scaffolding, is giving kids the opportunity to access advanced ideas by giving them little baby steps to reach there. And there's a lot of reasons why there's a gap. Sometimes the gap is awkwardness, and on an intellectual level, they could access it, but there's the awkwardness there. Sometimes they can't actually comprehend. But for the sake of the teaching, really, the gap is there and the gap is there. And why it's there, I think, is interesting, but the way to navigate it is oftentimes similar. I think also that humor is an incredible tool in helping kids talk about sex and sexuality. It's awkward, and people laugh because they're uncomfortable, and kids are going to laugh ninth graders are for sure, even when I talk to seniors about it, the seniors are laughing. Even when I talk to adults about it, adults laugh, right? It's awkward. You don't know what to do. And that awkwardness leads you to giggle. So by giving the kids opportunities to laugh at things that are clearly okay to laugh about, I tell them all the time, guys, you're always allowed to laugh at me. You're never allowed to laugh at each other. So I try to be, and I am, I'm ridiculous. I say hysterical things, I do hysterical things, and that's okay because it gives them the opportunity to laugh in a way that's super okay and super validated so that when we have to get serious, they can actually engage seriously in the conversation and in the learning.
Terrific.
Is there anything else you wanted to tell us that we didn't ask you about?
Yeah, I would like to take a minute to talk about parent education. I think that really at its core, educating about sexuality is something that, first of all, parents start doing from when their kids are infants. So parents are doing it anyway, even if they don't think that they are, or they're trying not to, then they're definitely sending their kids certain messages about sex. But really, it's such a personal part of each kid that it's really only in recent years that schools have started assuming the responsibility of doing values education, moral education, and part of those things tied up is sexuality education. It's a really, really hard thing for schools to tackle. So for anybody out there who's listening who has a kid who's having any form of sexuality education, please be proactive, but also be supportive. It's really hard to do because really at its core, I think it's something that's best done by parents. I wish I didn't have to teach.
You know how much I agree with you. I totally feel like the schools can only do so much, and it really and truly has to happen at home. And if the schools even start the conversation, the parents can continue the conversation. That's great.
Exactly. So the concern I actually have of teaching this sex ed class is that parents are going to find out that, oh, they're teaching sex ed in school. I don't have to talk about this, which is the exact opposite of what ideally we want to happen. So last year, the second year of teaching the course, was the first time I had some sort of parent education component, and I'm really hoping to expand that. And the parents kind of showed up at this event, and I think they were expecting me to tell them what I was teaching the kids, which I did. I gave them a little handout. But really what I did is I gave the parents a worksheet and I gave them individual thinking time, and they had to think for themselves and answer questions about their own perspectives about sex and sexuality and the things that they wanted ideally for their kids. Questions like, what is sex for? Where do you think your opinions about sex came from? What do I want my child's sex life to be like? I didn't make up these questions. I got them from an amazing book that actually you gave me, Dr. Marcus. It's called Everything You Never Wanted Your Kids to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid They'd Ask. And it's an amazing book and everyone should read it. But the reason why I do this is because parents, again, just like kids, in the moment when they have to make snap decisions about the way they're going to react to something that comes up, so many other things are happening in their brain, like panic, like, oh my God, maybe the kid is going to judge me if I say something, or oh, what do I do? This is so embarrassing. My grandmother is here, something like that, that they don't make thought out decisions based on what they really wish they were doing. So by providing parents the space, parent education about sexuality education is really educating parents about themselves and providing them with a space to think and then also share with their peers and hear from other parents what they think about these issues, particularly things like, would you feel or do you feel the same about your daughter's sexuality as you do about your son's? And that creates some real life tension and debate in the room. But the idea behind parent education is to help parents be aware of where their own biases are and where their own shortcomings are and where their own strengths are so that they can engage from a place of confidence and knowledge and clarity about what they want their kid to get out of the conversations. Parents know where they want their kids to go to college. They don't really know. They don't think about what they want their kids to get out of a sexual relationship.
That's amazing. So I just want to ask one last question about that, which is, here I am. I'm listening to you. I'm saying, I wish I had you as a teacher in this topic. And I'm thinking about all the people that are listening and saying, I wish my kid had you as a teacher, but they don't. So everybody out there who does not have good sex ed in their schools, what can they do?
Or even the people who do have good sex
ed. Or even the people that do, and the parents want to be doing their responsibility. Right. So you've mentioned one book. What other resources would you recommend for people to do this at home?
So I recommend this podcast. This is not a pre-planned plug. But again, I think that the experience of reading the book that I gave as an example, there's tons of books that are out there. And I think that just the experience for parents of making the decision to engage in thinking about these issues, listening to this podcast, maybe even listening to this podcast with your teenage children or older than teenage children, probably not younger, but teenage, high school age, 11, 12. Maybe 11, 12. But having that experience, listening and then talking about and sharing with their kids, parents, don't be so afraid. Really, nothing horrible is going to happen. The worst thing that can happen is that you're going to make a mistake. And you know what? You probably make parenting mistakes all the time. And that's fine, because it's not about a specific mistake that you make in one moment. It's about the fact that you're building a relationship with your child around these issues. And part of every relationship is mistakes, and that's okay. The important part is that it comes in a broader context of talking with your kids. So the first thing I would say is educate yourself, find books, read them, listen to the podcast, think about yourself, and create opportunities to talk to your kids about sex, and not in the like, okay, let's awkwardly sit down across the table from each other and say, do you have any questions? And then the kid says no. And then you say, oh, great, we're done here. That's not actually helpful.
Right.
Usually when you ask somebody if they have questions, the first thing that comes to their mind is no. Asking kids, what do you know about this? And forcing your kids to start talking, see where they're at. Once you create the opportunity for conversation, then that creates the backdrop of a trusting relationship in which if you make a mistake, it's okay, because you've already had so many good conversations and vulnerability with your child and openness about these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now a brief word from our sponsor.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Shira from JOFA, and I'm here to talk to you about our blog now being hosted by the Jewish Week. JOFA's blog is a place for you to voice your thoughts on anything and everything related to Jewish feminism, from feminist readings of this week's Parsha to what it's like to date as a Jewish feminist. The possibilities are endless, as long as you remain within our 1,000-word word limit. If you're interested in writing, contact me, Shira, at shira@jofa.org. I mean it. Contact me today, like right now, pause this episode and send me an email. I'll be waiting.
Today's final word is
SHBG. Actually, it's not final word. It's a final Rosh Hashanah.
Oh my God.
What does that mean?
It stands for sex hormone binding globulin, and it's a protein that your body makes. When you're on birth control pills, it shoots up your SHBG, this protein, very high. This protein actually eats or absorbs or connects to testosterone and binds it. The testosterone makes it unusable in your body, which is why sometimes women who are on birth control pills find that their desire goes down. It's not true for everybody, but for some women, getting on birth control pills brings up your SHBG, and that could really affect your desire level. And I just feel like it's an important thing for women to be aware of and know. And so that's why my final word today is SHBG. And dope.
Oh my God. Okay.
Today's final words are...
Well, paralleling something that a woman would take and that would have an effect possibly on her sexual drive or is taken for the purposes of birth control, there's something called Kostel Ikarin, which means a cup, a potion of roots made from some type of medicinal roots, which the Talmud discusses as something a woman would take that would cause sterility. And actually, it's in the context of the fact that a woman is not obligated in the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying. And it actually has a fascinating story where a woman asked her husband, who was a rabbi, actually she dressed up so he didn't know who was asking the question, are women commanded in being fruitful and multiply? And her husband said no. And then she had very difficult childbirth, so she went ahead and she drank this potion so that she would have no more children, which raises a really interesting question about similar applications nowadays. And some halachic decisors make a distinction between when the husband can marry another wife at that time, you know, could have multiple wives, so maybe the woman had more latitude to do that. Nowadays, she would have to be hopefully in conversation with her husband if she wanted to do that. But the Gemara has no discussion about how it might affect her desire level.
Sadly, this is going to be the last Joy of Text that Rabbi Raimi is going to be with us. She's going on to bigger and better things, so she joins Mayim Bialik. What exactly are you doing there? You're going to be the
producer and director of video on Rock Nation, which is Mayim's website.
So I know that's been your dream, and Dov and I wanted an opportunity to...
Yeah, we're going to so miss you, Raimi. It's been so wonderful working with you, and your questions representing the younger generation have kept us honest and engaged, and we're really going to miss you. It's been so wonderful.
Thank you, and I want to thank both of you Dr. Marcus, you've become in so many ways my Rebbe, teaching me inside the studio and welcoming me to your teaching space outside the studio. Thank you for your guidance and your love and support over the last 3 years. And Rebbe Linzer, you are my Rebbe
in everything.
And it's been a pleasure to have you across the hall to ask questions to this year. And to the listeners of Joy of Text, thank you for going along this journey with me, with us, and you've pushed me to be a better rabbinic presence, a better listener, and to ask more thoughtful, inclusive questions. So thank you so much for this incredible experience, and I'm gonna so miss being a part of it, and so much love to everyone.
Thank you.
I'm crying, this is ridiculous.
If you have any questions for the show, you could submit them anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org. Thank you, Ora Weinbach, for joining us on this episode. The Joy of Text is produced by Jewish Public Media, which is supported in part by a grant from Next and Atan. This episode was recorded by Mike Hurst and edited by Michal Richardson. You can listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or with any podcast app. My name is Rami Smith, and thank you so much for listening.